Tonight on Arena, Juliette Stevenson on her new film, Reawakening, and Michael Riesman, longtime collaborator with composer Philip Glass. Five on 551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The loss of a child is truly the most appalling vista. Can a relationship withstand the torrent of grief? And how would the relationship adapt if the missing child were to return years later? These are the questions at the centre of Virginia Gilbert's new film, Reawakening. It stars Jared Harris and Juliette Stevenson as John and Mary, whose relationship has survived the most difficult of times and is now severely tested when they seem to get the very thing they've wished for years, the return of their missing daughter, Claire, played by Erin Doherty. Film opens in cinemas this Friday, and delighted to be welcoming Juliette Stevenson to Arena this evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the programme, Juliette. Great to have you there.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Virginia Gilbert's script, when you read it, there must have been something within it that really caught your imagination. What was it?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, it's a wonderful script. Mm. I'd known her for a while. We tried to make another film together years ago, which was also brilliant. And then that didn't happen. But this one arrived. I read it. And, you know, it doesn't take, if a script is great, it takes you no time. You know, you just know this just has it, you know. And I think, you know, every parent listening will know that the ultimate nightmare is to lose a child. And this couple have only one. And she walks out the door, and perhaps even worse than losing a child to death is to lose a child and not know what happened to them. And for 10 years, that's been the case. And I think she explores it with such kind of emotional intelligence and imagination. And it's such a brilliant take on that situation that, because, of course, my character, the mother, does believe that it is my daughter returning 10 years later, but my husband does not. And so they are having stuck together for all this time, you know, and still loving each other through the ultimate difficulty, they then find themselves in very, very different places.
Let's listen.
So it's kind of a thriller. You know, it's a thriller in a way as well.
Yeah. There is that aspect to it. And this clip from quite early on in the, well, a little bit into the film, we've seen the difficulties they've been going through for the decade at this stage. And then John, played by Jared Harris, arrives home and he's greeted by Mary, played by yourself, Juliette Stevenson.
Mary?
John!
You didn't call, your phone was off.
Stop!
What is it?
Stop! John. She's here.
Who's here?
Claire.
Mary, come.
No, John, listen. She's come home.
Stop.
No, you're not listening. It's
just
happened.
Stop.
John, it's happened. It's finally happened. It's today. It's now. I'm so sorry I didn't call you, but she was waiting for me. She was on the doorstep.
That's Juliette Stevenson as Mary in a scene from Reawakening. Jared Harris playing the character of John, her husband, and their daughter, who has disappeared or had disappeared, has suddenly come back in the front door. And the thriller aspect is we start to wonder about what has happened and who she is and all the rest of it. But the sheer emotion, even in that clip that we just heard, Juliette, the whole film is wrought with emotion. How wrought a task was it for you, particularly in the role of Mary?
Well, it is. And that clip, of course, there were times which were like that. But there are also quite a lot of scenes which is just them kind of going about their daily business. I mean, just looking at the grind of their lives, you know, just getting through every day. And then there were lots of scenes. There was a halfway house when Claire, the daughter, comes back, and there are uncomfortable scenes sitting around the kitchen table where they're trying not to feel anything. They're trying not to get emotional. And I guess there's more scenes where they're trying not to get angry, cry, get overexcited, hurt each other, you know, than there are feelings than there are scenes when they actually let it out, which is like life. You know, we all try very hard not to let things spill over. But it was certainly, it's a very intense film, but I think it's also, It's a very smart film. You know, it's an intelligent film. It's not just a lot of gushing and...
Not at all, yes. We spoke to Jared Harris when the film premiered at the Dublin International Film Festival some time back. He was in studio with me on the night. And one of the things I spoke to him about, and I would ask you about too, is the nature... You're right. There are quite ordinary scenes of nothing happening or ordinary things happening in their house. A very intimate type of situation. How did Virginia Gilbert go about achieving that on set? And the chemistry between yourself and Jared Harris was very obvious, just the ease.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing. You know, if you're playing a married couple in a play, in a theatre, you know, you rehearse for 5-6 weeks. And you get ready, you know, you have all that time to get to know each other, to prepare the history of the relationship. On the film, you have 5 or 6 minutes, you know, and then suddenly you're shooting a scene where you're in bed with a man who you're supposed to have lived with for 30 years, or, you know, you're cooking together, and you're very, very dependent on each other, you know. And I just feel myself incredibly lucky that it was Jared, because I didn't know him from Adam. We had a pint a couple of days before we started shooting, and we were a bit nervous and shy, you know, the way you are. And then we started shooting, and I don't know, there was just this, I just got felt able to love him. He was so open. He was so up for telling the story together, which is not that common. You know, some actors come on set, and they've made all their decisions, and they just play with the camera. And you'd have to think, oh, my God, how am I going to make a relationship with this person? But I just felt he and I were just sort of opened up to each other. And we have a very wonderful director who made that possible, who encouraged us, who created the space, even in a crazy tight schedule, you know, because the film was made for, you know, a couple of quid, a bag of peanuts, because it's British. You know, but she made the space. She prioritized that. And so I think that we were able to kind of go... really establish a kind of intimacy quite quickly, which is sort of weird but wonderful.
Let's have a listen. Of course, the whole thing is thrown awry, as I said, when Erin Dougherty's character appears, the character of Claire. And as you said, Juliet, initially, Mary's kind of going, yep, she's back. Let's get on with things. You know, the nightmare is over. John, played by Jared Harris, is not quite so certain about it all, and he wants to find more out. So around the kitchen table, this is one of those awkward scenes that you're talking about. Here is where Jared Harris's character starts to test Erin Dougherty on some things that happened in the past.
What do we do for your 9th birthday?
You don't have to.
She doesn't know.
What is the matter with you?
You don't know, do you?
My 9th was at a party. Sorry, my memory.
It's all right, sweetheart. You don't have to.
She can't.
Will you just leave her alone?
Wait, was that the one that we went into town? The Lion King, wasn't it?
Erin Dougherty there joining in the scene. And again, what a trio you make in Erin Dougherty. People will know her from The Crown. We spoke about her recently in the film Firebrand. One of a new generation of actors coming up who's bringing something really dynamic to the screen and to the stage.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I saw her in a play, you know, years ago. I took my son to a play. It was a one-woman show she was doing. Nobody knew her. She was just a newcomer. And I was completely blown away. And I saw her afterwards in the auditorium, and I kind of jumped on her, and I said, you're amazing, you're amazing. I think she thought, who is this mad woman? But, she's a huge talent.
Of course, I can't talk to you without talking about this.
I love you. I really love you.
Really, truly love you.
I really, truly, madly love you.
Really, truly, madly, deeply love you.
I really, truly, madly, deeply, passionately love you.
Really, truly, madly, deeply, passionately, remarkably love you.
I really, truly, madly, deeply, passionately, remarkably. Deliciously love you.
Really, truly, madly, passionately, remarkably, deliciously, juicily.
Deeply. You passed on deeply, which was your word, which means that you couldn't have meant it. So you're a fraud, actually. You're probably a figment of my imagination.
And there we have Alan Rickman and Juliet Stevenson, of course, in Truly, Madly, Deeply. I can only imagine, Juliet Stevenson, that listening to that clip must bring back a flood of memories apart from anything else. And just the sheer the impact that film had at the time was enormous.
Yeah, isn't it funny? I mean, that was another film made for, you know, Ken and Tipton. I mean, but I think it's true that both films are made, you know, by early young directors. I mean, it was Anthony Minghella's first film. We'd worked together a lot as a, he is a writer, but it was the first film he ever directed. And it had this kind of, he just changed all the rules. And I think when people are directing their first film, they often do that. He changed all the rules in the best possible way. And again, he made that film set entirely about the actors and what needed to be found. Some of those scenes were incredibly demanding, like emotionally as well, you know, like, and other scenes like this one, he just sort of didn't really know what he wanted, and he just let Alan and I play, you know, just play. The script was there, but he just gave us free rein. And of course, the great thing was that many of those actors in the film, you know, we were all friends. We'd known each other for a long time, and Alan was like a sort of big brother to me. You know, I met him when I was 20, he was 30. And so there was a lot of that history went into the film.
Yeah. Very different from the Jared Harris type, a different type of chemistry. But also in Truly, Madly, Deeply, it has to be said, you give good crying. There's serious grief. There's serious grief in that film as well.
Yeah, oh God, there is, yeah. I know, I mean, for some years after Truly Madly Deeply came out, you know, all I was asked to do was, you know, endless sort of wacky, scatty young women who, you know, whose hearts were broken. I had to be really careful not to get myself, you know, sort of boxed in, playing just one kind of person, but yeah.
Yeah, you've often spoken about the difficulty of the industry for women. Has that improved anything in recent times, do you think?
I do. I mean, I think it has improved. You know, the big issue is I think it's fairly equal for women up to the age of about 35. And then there's a falling off. And by 40, 45, it starts to get very unequal. And then when you look at, you know, it can be catastrophic after the age of 45. Not many actresses make it through those difficult years of their 50s and their 60s, or if they do, they're playing tiny roles as somebody's secretary or somebody's granny or something, or they've got a penny on and they're playing, you know, they're coming in with a tray of food. It's much better than it was, but there's loads of room for improvement.
And is that down to, I mean, as you describe it there, you're talking about the parts are disappearing as much as anything else. The great roles are gone. Is that really at the heart of it, or are there other factors at play?
It's really hard to know what the factors are. I think it's largely parts. I mean, I think if you look at society, it's always a reflection of the world. You know, I think for men, aging doesn't really matter. You can, you know, look at George Clooney. You know, he can get married in his 50s or whatever. He's still a sex symbol. He's 60 years old, whatever. He's still a sex symbol. It's not an issue. Getting a few wrinkles only makes him sexier. But, of course, it's not the case for women. You know, there are these sort of preconditions about what makes a woman attractive, what makes a woman have sexual value. There's all this stuff which we so need to sort of clean out of our closet. You know, there are wonderful examples where that's not happening, but we can name them. Whereas for men, you know, the thing is that men, there is no halt in the trajectory of their careers. There's no plateau where it gets difficult for them. Whereas for women, there's an infamous plateau. And although some people are very lucky to get through that time, and I'm probably one of them, yet I'm so aware that I have many friends who didn't get through it, and brilliant talents who just, you know. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done. And I think it's all about writing, really, and about people commissioning women or recognizing that women's stories are as interesting and as valuable.
Well, it's also, I suppose, about people like Samuel Beckett, of whom I know you are a practitioner and a fan. And it brings us to Anthony Minghella again, who in the Beckett on Film season had yourself, Alan Rickman and Kristen Scott. Now, doesn't matter what age the person is here, they're in a clay pot and all they have to do is speak really quickly like this.
I said to him, give her up. I swore by all I held my sacred.
One morning as I was sitting stitching by the open window, she burst in and flew at me. Give him up, she screamed. He's mine. Her photographs were kind to her. Seeing her now for the first time, full length in the flesh, I understood why he preferred me.
We were not long together when she smelled the rat. Give up that horse, she said, or I'll cut my throat. Pardon, so help me God. I knew she could have no proof, so I told her I did not know what she was talking about.
What are you talking about? I said, stitching away. Someone yours, give up whom? I smell you off him, she screamed. He stinks of bitch.
Though I had him dogged for months by a first-rate man, no shadow of proof was forthcoming. There was no denying that he continued as assiduous as ever. This and his horror of the merely platonic thing made me sometimes wonder if I were not accusing him unjustly, yes.
What have you to complain of? I said, have I been neglecting you? How could we be together in the way we are if there was someone else? Loving her as I did with all my heart, I could not but feel sorry for her.
Fearing she was about to offer me violence, I rang for Erskine and had her shown out her parting words as he could testify if he's still living and has not forgotten, coming and going on the earth, letting people in, showing people out, what are the effects that she would settle my hash. I confess it did alarm me a little at the time.
She was not convinced, I'm not alone. I smell her.
And there we go. And we have to fade it out because it just keeps going. And then when it ends, it starts again. That's Juliet Stevenson, Alan Rickman and Kristen Scott Thomas in Urns in Samuel Beckett's play Coldplay, which was in fact part of the Beckett on Film season directed by Anthony Minghella. Doing that in a film situation is one thing. Doing that in the theatre, which you probably have done at some point along the way, I mean, the demands on the actor are just extraordinary.
Yeah, I have indeed. I did Not I.
Yeah.
And I did Happy Days.
Yeah.
Happy Days, which, I mean, Happy Days for a woman is, I think, Hamlet for a man. You know, it's a sort of the absolute peak, and there's nothing. And I got very, very bad stage fright before I started working on Happy Days. The thought of being stuck on stage and literally not able to move or get out, you know, and having nobody else really. I mean, there's Willie, you know, moving around down somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But I am sort of number one fan. I just think the man is a genius, and he just has this extraordinary, profound understanding of women, and particularly trapped women, women who have no profile in society at all, women whose natures are absolutely stuck and buried, and the sort of desperation, the optimism, the ways they find of carrying on with life when life is not rewarding them or giving them anything back. What he gave to actresses, that writer, is just phenomenal. Really.
It is extraordinary to think that a man in mid-20th century could write parts for women that have really sustained. Here we are almost a century later, well, not quite a century, but 75 years later, and those parts are, as you have described them, the peak of what any actress would want to address and approach.
Yeah. It's so true, Sean. And, you know, I think what it does is, you know, I'm very anxious about the sort of current idea that you cannot speak for anybody unless you've had that lived experience yourself. Because while, of course, it's true for certain people, and it's important that we remember that. But, you know, if you're a really big talent, if you have an imagination the size of a Minghella or a Samuel Beckett or a Shakespeare or an Ibsen, you do understand what it's like to be a woman trapped. I mean, look at Ibsen in The Dollhouse. You know, when you play Nora in The Dollhouse, you feel that Ibsen has this uncanny understanding profoundly of this woman. How can that be? But he did. And I think we do all have the capacity to understand what it feels like to be completely other than yourself. And that's where compassion comes from. And it's where tolerance comes from and understanding of each other comes from. And I think it's so important to keep that alive, you know.
It's a related topic, I think, that, you know, the idea of somebody with a profile like yours, when you speak out about social issues or political issues, that may have changed in recent times too. You've often spoken in favour of refugees. You've called for a ceasefire in Gaza. Having that kind of openly, you know, those open political and social statements, has the attitude to that changed, do you think, in recent times?
The attitude to what? Sorry, the attitude to speaking out.
Yeah, to speaking out, exactly.
Well, I think some people don't want you to. Some people get angry. And obviously, speaking out about Gaza is, you know, you get a huge amount of kickback. Obviously, most people are frightened to do it. Most people in my industry are not doing it, to my great grief, to be honest. Because I think what we're witnessing there, you know, the events of October the 7th were horrific. And my heart goes out to every hostage and every family and friendship circle of those hostages. But what's happened since is a humanitarian catastrophe. You know, 15,000 children killed and many, many more dying now. And for the world to be silent about that, for anybody to be silent about that who could be speaking up, seems to me a crime, you know. And I just can't. I don't know what else to do with my responses to that stuff other than try and find something useful to say or do, like fundraise or try and call it out. Because it's very hard to see that stuff and go about your daily life. I mean, it makes me feel mad. Mm. You know, I think, what are our lives for? You know, if people are suffering, what is the difference between me and a woman in Gaza? Do they love their children less? Of course they don't. So why are we allowing this to happen? When if it happened to even five children in one of our countries, you know, there'd be an outrage. So I just don't understand this phenomenal injustice, this apartheid. you know, and I know that I will get into a huge amount of trouble for saying it, but I just can't not
speak out. Let me bring it back to the theatre. You mentioned Winnie from Beckett is the Hamlet character for a woman. Now, you did play opposite a young Irish whippersnapper in the role of Gertrude, and he being Hamlet. Let us listen to an interaction between Andrew Scott as Hamlet and yourself as his mother, Gertrude.
Now, mother, what's the matter?
Hamlet, thou hast thy father much offended.
Mother, you have my father much offended.
Oh, come, you answer with an idle tongue.
Go, you question with a wicked tongue.
Why, how now, Hamlet?
What's the matter now?
Have you forgotten me?
No, by the root, not so. You are the queen, your husband's brother's wife. And would you were not so, you are my mother.
No. Then I've sent those to you that can't speak!
Go sit! Oh. You down! You shall not budge till I set you up a glass where you may see the inmost part of you!
Why? What will you do?
There's a stage to be on. That's Andrew Scott as Hamlet and Juliet Stevenson as Gertrude. And we hear a little click-click at the end of that, which is a gun, I think, being cocked into your face. There was an unfortunate incident, thankfully not dreadful, but an unfortunate incident with that gun one night.
There was indeed. It went off. Andrew, has to be said, Andrew Scott is a brilliant actor, but he's not brilliant with the old firearms. And he absolutely hated that gun, and he loathed it. And one night it went off when it wasn't supposed to, very close to my face. I was fine, you know, these things happen. But and we got to the end of the scene, and then it was the interval. He came tearing around in my dressing room, and the interval, he said, oh my God, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. Calm down. I loved it. It was exciting. When you do a show 8 times a week, there's a terrible danger you get bored, you know. And so anything new that happens is always a bit of a thrill. So yeah, he tells that story. But oh man, he was. It was so exciting, that show. It was really wonderful.
Yeah, and if you'll forgive us for being a little bit parochial and wanting to play him, because I mean he's a phenomenal actor. I mean a bit like Erin Doherty, you know, bringing a kind of a new energy into both stage and screen that is quite extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I've known Andrew for a very long time, and we worked together before he was well known. And I kept thinking, what the hell? I mean, this guy is extraordinary. He's just standout brilliant. And why isn't he, you know, why isn't he more famous? I think anybody who worked with him years and years ago felt that. And then suddenly it happened. And everything that's happened to him since is absolutely deserved.
It's amazing the effect a hot priest can have on a career.
Indeed.
Finally, Juliet, a great joy to speak with you. But what is coming up next for you? Obviously, I know Reawakening is coming into cinemas. Are you in the midst of other project?
I've just finished filming a fantastic, I've done 3 TV series this year, so there's a big old BBC sort of historical costume drama with James Norton starring in it coming out called King and Conqueror on the BBC, and then there's another series of Professor T, which is really great, and then there's a very exciting series that we've just shot in Europe called The Deal, which is all about the Iran-US nuclear deal in 2015, and in which I play the American negotiator, Under Secretary of State. It sounds very dry, but it's not. It's really interesting, intelligent, kind of, yeah. It's all the private stories that go on behind those huge sort of political headlines. So it's exciting, that one.
Well, lots more to speak about. I hope at any point you're in this part of the world, Juliet, you're more than welcome into this studio. It's been an absolute privilege and joy to speak with you this evening.
Me too, Sean. Thanks so much for having me.
Not at all. That's Juliet Stevenson and Juliet's new film. It is called Reawakening. It goes on general release this Friday. Philip Glass is one of the most influential and groundbreaking composers of the 20th and 21st centuries, known for pioneering minimalist music and contemporary classical composition. From iconic works like Einstein on the Beach to film scores for The Truman Show and The Hours, Glass has collaborated with artists across various disciplines, creating music that transcends genre and form. Michael Riesman, a close collaborator of Glass and music director of the Philip Glass Ensemble, has worked alongside the composer for decades, shaping many of his notable works. head of the Philip Glass Ensemble's residency at the National Concert Hall, where they will perform Glassworks and the Irish premiere of Na Caoimh Catzí with the National Symphony Orchestra. I'm delighted to be joined on the telephone this evening by Michael Riesemann. Michael, great to have you with us on the programme here on Arena. You have a long, it has to be said, a long history with Philip Glass. In fact, probably going back to your father a little bit before you were involved with him.
Well, that my father part of it doesn't really have any effect on how my life with Philip went. I hooked up with him in 1974, so it's been 50 years, which is quite a while. Philip was a student at the University of Chicago where my father was a professor. Mm. So, I had no concept of him then. He wasn't yet writing music. He was studying mathematics.
Yeah, at that time. So, a different era for Philip Glass, and indeed, obviously, you were a young boy at the time. But I'm interested then, at what point in the 60s and 70s did you, as a young music student, begin to hear the music of Philip Glass, and how exciting was that? It was a very vibrant time in New York.
It was indeed. I had been studying at Harvard to getting my graduate degree in composition. And then I spent a year in Vienna. When I came back, I said, well, what do I want to do? I really wanted to live in New York. I wasn't quite sure what else I might be doing. But I moved to downtown New York, and that was the beginning of my introduction to the local art scene here. I got to know people in the local Soho scene, artists and musicians, and Philip Glass was a name that came up, what about this kind of music, And I went to a concert in a loft. Then I went to, another concert later on in Town Hall, New York, when he did the first performance of Music in 12 Parts in the spring of 1974. And that summer, he was working with his regular group, and the keyboard player decided to drop out, and he needed another person to come into the group. And that's when I joined the ensemble in the fall of 1974 for my first tour with him.
Mm. And so 1974 until now, here we are, as you say, exactly half a century later, and still, yes, still the collaboration continues. I suppose you became musical director of the Philip Glass Ensemble, I think, within a couple of years after that initial arrival as the keyboard player. What was it that Philip Glass was doing that so captured the imagination, the musical imagination at the time? I think particularly, and it's a little bit later on into the 80s, with Glassworks, with that album, he seemed to transcend this idea of art music or pop music or rock music. He managed to just have glass music, a kind almost of its own.
Well, that's well put, yes. In fact, he did. I mean, he's been labeled a minimalist and labeled a sellout. Mm-hmm. And whatever you want to call him, he was following his own ideal and own ideas about what music should be and how it should be written. And, he had formed his own ensemble because he didn't want to have to be dependent on somebody else to like his music, appreciate it, or figure out how to do it. He wanted to basically be in charge of his whole musical production. And when I fit into this organization, he needed, at the point of doing pieces like Glassworks or the early films, Quinus Kazi, or Einstein on the Beach, that was a couple of years after I signed up with him, he needed somebody basically to become a conductor, music director for these bigger productions. And I just happened to have studied conducting when I was in music school. And so, I'm a conductor. Here I am, So he said, okay, you do it. So that's how I stepped into the role of music director.
And you were the music director in the recording, I think, of Glassworks. Let's have a listen to, I think this is probably one of the best known tracks from the Glassworks album, Facade.
Thank you.
the opening of Facade there from the album Glassworks, played by the Philip Glass Ensemble. And with me this evening is the music director of that ensemble, Michael Reisman, who will be in the National Concert Hall next month for the two-night residency of the Philip Glass Ensemble, and also involving a collaboration with the National Symphony Orchestra. You know, as I listen to Facade there, there is a simplicity in it, and this is possibly where that label of minimalist often comes from. You know, there are a couple of small musical ideas there, and they are repeated, and I think that's often how he is, Philip Glass, is dismissed. How deceptive and how difficult is it to get that kind of simplicity, Michael?
Well, one thing is it requires great rhythmic accuracy to make it work. The band has to be perfectly together, ensemble-wise. That's, you know, not in that particular piece that you played, Facade. It's not difficult to play the accompaniment parts, but some of the other pieces from Glassworks, such as Rubric, for example, are, you know, have a lot of fast arpeggios that need to be precisely together to make it work.
And I'm guessing cross rhythms going on with one section of the ensemble possibly playing in one time signature and another playing in another time signature, which makes the conductor's role quite important in that situation.
That's right. Yeah. Well, of course, in the ensemble, I don't conduct exactly. I'm one of the keyboard players in the ensemble.
Yeah, you're directing from there.
I will be conducting with the National Symphony Orchestra in the performance of Nekrokazi, where I don't play, I'm conducting instead.
Yeah, the Nekrokazi is the third part of the Katzi trilogy of films that Philip Glass was involved in with Godfrey Reggio. I was looking at Glass's his biography today, Words Without Music, and he describes that moment when he was asked about writing the music for this film, and he basically said to Godfrey Reggio, "Thanks very much. I don't write music for films." That changed fundamentally when he met Reggio. What do you think it was that was so important about Reggio's visual and artistic vision that persuaded Philip Glass to not only compose the music for this, but for several other films, including The Hours, where you played the piano?
Yes. Well, you know, just to complete that story about how Reggio convinced him to do the film. He didn't even want to look at it to begin with. And Reggio says, "Come on, I really wanted to show this to you." And then when he did show it to him, he played him an excerpt to which he had attached some arbitrary music. And then he played him the same excerpt to which he had attached a piece by Philip Glass. And then he said to Philip, "See how much better that is?" And that kind of was the winning line for Philip to see, actually this works, when he saw his own music put up against the images that Godfrey has. And then he got totally in immersed in that. And that was a collaboration that went on for almost a year of him writing music and me doing demos and getting it all put together over an unimaginable time period for creation of a film score.
Yeah.
And so that was the first one, the Crying Scuzzy, the first score of the three. We're doing the third one in...
You're doing Nekoya Skatsi, which is, as you say, the third part of the trilogy, which features cello to a large... The cello really plays a hugely important role in this score. I want to listen to a section of the score called Media Weather, which really highlights... It's one of the tracks that highlights the melodic facility of the cello.
Yes.
Thank you. Just a short section there from Media Weather, part of the score for Nakoi Katsi for cello and orchestra and the Philip Glass Ensemble, which, and Michael Riesman, who's conducting that piece on the second night of the residency at the Philip Glass residency, ensemble residency at the National Concert Hall, is joining me on the telephone this evening. There are some beautifully melodic sections within this piece, but it looks, the film looks at the, to simplify it, and I know Philip Glass says it's a lot more subtle than this, but it does look at the rise of technology and, I suppose, the interplay between contemporary technology, modern technology, and ancient civilizations and a more, I suppose, indigenous type of existence. Does the film play any part, any role in your mind, Michael, when you're conducting the orchestral score? Is it there in any way?
Well, the film is there because I'm looking at it, and I'm actually doing all of my synchronization just by watching the images, and I don't use a click track or other artificial system to keep in sync. What I've done is to mark my score with events that are lined up to specific moments in a bar down to the accuracy of a 16th note so that I know if I'm hitting the cues. And, you know, the synchronization, it's not super critical that I'm exactly in time. I can be a little ahead or a little behind within a second or two. And it's not significant because there's no, like, hit points where, you know, action on the screen, like
yes.
a cartoon Mickey Mouse where you have to have the, you know, bop come where you see the thing
yes.
hit somebody's head. So that doesn't exist in these films. So I can push and pull a little bit. And the idea is you never want to get far away from where you want to be so that you can just, it can be an organic performance. And that's what I strive for. And that's one of the reasons I don't like to use and never used click tracks or other artificial ways to stay in sync with the film, which is what mostly happens with film scores.
I suppose there is a beautiful irony there that in a film about technology, you avoid the click track technology
yes.
and rely on the organic nature of conducting. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, Michael.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Michael Riesman, and full details of the Philip Glass residency, which takes place on the 10th and 11th of October at the National Concert Hall, are available on the website, nch.ie. Both of those concerts are part of the National Concert Hall's International Concert Season 2024-25, runs from September of this year through until May of next year. Over 60 concerts by leading Irish and visiting international orchestras, conductors, soloists and ensembles from all around the world. And full details of them as well on nch.ie. The 90s was the decade when haute couture strutted off the catwalk and mingled with mainstream culture, when glamorous supermodels were sidelined to make way for grunge Kate Moss and heroin chic. This week, as New York Fashion Week kicks off, Disney Plus launches a landmark documentary series telling the story of fashion during this fascinating decade. A-listers abound. Stars like Nicole Kidman and Gwyneth Paltrow, designers Tom Ford and Donna Karan, models Linda Evangelista and Naomi Campbell, and of course Vogue editors and directors like Grace Coddington, Edward Enninful, and the doyen of them all, Anna Wintour. Joining me to discuss the series is Irish designer Don O'Neill, who has dressed hundreds of celebrities, including Taylor Swift and Oprah Winfrey, and worked in fashion houses with Christian Lacroix in Paris and Carmen Mark Valvo in New York. Don, the decade, the 1990s, it's such an important decade in the history of fashion. It's not surprising that that's where the documentary series lands itself. Why was it such an important decade in your mind?
Well, hello, Sean, first of all. Lovely to be chatting to you this evening about my favourite decade in fashion. And it's the decade that I came of age in, which makes it even doubly more exciting. But really, it was the age that put up with the beginning of the supermodels, when fashion models became household names and everybody knows the name of Cindy and Christy and Naomi and the supermodels that they were at the time. Mm. And then I guess there was just so much excitement around the various designers at the time, and there was so much happening so rapidly within that decade. We sort of had come out of the 80s with the the big puff shoulders and the sequins and the glamour of the 80s as we knew from the Dynasty days. And then the 90s started with the event of the supermodels being on the cover of British Vogue, actually, in January of 1990. And that era sort of quickly came to a sort of a close with the arrival of Kate Moss, believe it or not.
Yeah,
she turned fashion on its head. And there were so many ups and downs and U-turns in the fashion world. It was dizzying and super exciting.
One of the things that the series does in its first episode is that it talks about, you know, up until this point, maybe in the late 80s, that fashion, film, music were very much separate entities. Those worlds didn't mix in together. Yet in the 90s, they kind of mished and mashed in and out of each other. And fashion in particular was hugely affected by this.
And I think so. And I think Anna Wintour played a big role in this. And obviously the series is in vogue and it's seen through the Vogue lens. But she did something revolutionary by putting Madonna on the cover of Vogue and sort of embracing popular culture. So there would have been, fashion would have been sort of in its own world and a little bit hoity at the time. And Anna was determined to go with the times as she has always done and sort of move with the times. Mm. And Madonna was such an unexpected choice for the cover back then because she was so controversial, but it was the perfect choice. She was brave and Madonna was brave, and it was just the mesh of two fabulous cultures at the time.
Let's have a listen to Anna Wintour talking about this. So she was in Vogue in London, an editor there, and then she was asked to take over the editorial tasks in New York. And here she is from the documentary series talking about her ideas when she went there.
I grew up in England back in the 60s. I was interested in the world of fashion because it was such an explosive time in London then. My dad was a London Fleet Street newspaper editor. He also had a reputation for being a little bit tough. I first started working in journalism when I was in my late teens. And like so many things in life, it just unfolded.
These are the colors. What do you think?
Fabulous.
Great.
Oh, it's going to be a wonderful sitting.
Condé Nast asked me to join Vogue as editor-in-chief because they felt it was time for change. Under the previous leadership, every cover of Vogue looked all the same. Very close up, airbrushed, big hair, big makeup, big earrings. Everything was very ornate. Sometimes you just need to tear everything up and start over.
And that's Anna Wintour in a clip from In Vogue in the 90s, the new Disney Plus series that Irish designer Don O'Neill is speaking to me about this evening. She says in the midst of that clip, Don, about her father, he had a reputation for being a little bit tough. she lives in the same place herself.
She is, but you know what? I think Anna's strength was in being tough. And I think the viewers will really get to appreciate Anna. And what I liked about her saying that at very early on, she says, to be successful, you need to surround yourself by brilliant people and not to surround yourself by yes people. So even though she was tough, and especially with Grace Coddington, she explains in the series that Grace and herself used to work together at British Vogue, and Grace quit because she couldn't work for Anna. She didn't like what Anna was doing with British Vogue. Yet when Anna came to American Vogue, one of the first people she spoke with or that spoke with her was Grace. And she convinced Grace to come back and challenge her. And she challenged her and they rowed, but the end result was amazing.
Yeah. And she seems to thrive on that idea that people will challenge her thoughts. There's a great scene, too, quite early on where the camera person has the temerity to ask Anna Wintour to take off her dark glasses. And it's just a curt no.
No.
I won't be taking them off. You met her, I think, recently enough. Was she wearing the dark glasses? And how did you, what sort of person did you meet in Anna Wintour, Don?
I was fortunate enough to meet Anna at her home. So no dark glasses at home because it's her environment. And Anna was, it was a very special evening because it was when Sam Barry was announced as the editor of Glamour magazine, and there was a party thrown for her by Anna at her home, and there was a whole slew of who's who invited, and it was wonderful to be there that evening. And I was one of the very first to arrive that evening, and Sam was the first person to greet me as I got to the top of the stairs. And in the room was only Anna Wintour and Vera Wang, so I was it was just the three of us in the room, and Anna was very gracious. I was a little bit over-huggy, a little bit over-friendly, which wasn't actually the way to go with Anna Wintour, but she was very gracious and very humble. And my overreaction was sort of tempered later in the evening when she came back to me in a conversation with Michael Kors about the latest Broadway show, and she was very pleasant and very courteous that evening.
Going back to the series in vogue in the 90s, the Disney Plus series, Don, The famous George Michael video, which had four of the five big supermodels involved in it at the time. It was Cindy Crawford, Naomi Campbell, Linda Evangelista, and Christy Turlington were involved in it, I think. But Claudia Schiffer was told not to be going anywhere near a pop video. That was a huge moment. And also, Irish Linen makes an appearance.
Well, that was news to me. And for me, that was the superstar, because I know that video inside out and loved it and grew up with it. And to see Christy, I knew Christy walked through the room wrapped up in a big white sheet, but Camilla Nickerson tells the story of being hired to be the editor of that video. And David Finchley, who filmed it or who directed it, he specifically wanted a giant Irish linen sheet, and specifically Irish linen for the sheet. And it cost Camilla the entire budget, practically the entire budget for the costumes to procure that sheet. But there's this beautiful scene of our gorgeous Irish linen sheet being dragged through the room, wrapped around Christy Turlington. So for me, that was a huge surprise among many surprises, a wonderful surprise to see on screen.
And in that first episode too, then we see the fall of the disappearance of the supermodels, or at least the temporary disappearance of the supermodels, and the rise of Kate Moss, and a much... almost anti-fashion statement being made, which the fashion business took on board.
Well, it's amazing throughout the series that I've seen so far, with the ups and downs, with the end of Glamour, and then the arrival of Kate Moss, who was sort of the waif, and then there was the whole arrival of grunge. All of a sudden, the supermodels were panicking because Calvin Klein one season booked none of them for his show. He went with all with Kate Moss and Amber Valletta and all these new young girls, and they were panicking. But meanwhile, the girls were all smart enough. Christy and Linda Evangelista both had their hair chopped off to stay relevant. And it worked. All of a sudden, they had that cool factor, and ID magazine in London was played a big role in the cool factor and the hip factor. And obviously Kate Moss was hip and cool, but then it ended up, Linda ended up being on the cover, Christy was on the cover, and all of a sudden any model who was on the cover of ID in London was deemed cool. So the supermodels sort of came back to the fore, but not the way they were, but there was a whole new cool school, and they revived themselves. I guess reinvention is the story of fashion.
Yeah, and I suppose part of that was the famous Linda Evangelista statement about, I don't get out of bed for less than $10,000.
And you see her wincing.
Yeah, even today in a contemporary interview, she's still going, why did I say it?
Yeah, the poor thing. She really regrets it, because she was such a spectacular model, and that's all people remember her for, and she really was so much more than that quote.
If you can put off the designer's hat for just a moment, Don, do you think there's enough in this series for the non-fashionista, for somebody who's just coming in as an interested observer? Because there's as much social history in it as there is fashion history.
Oh, there is, because, I mean, everyone knows the Freedom video, and everybody, and with the not only just music, but also the film industry and the celebrities, and it crosses so many, it's just... There's so much to see. It truly is entertaining. I mean, Pascal sat here and watched it with me, and he was as fascinated. I mean, I'm utterly fascinated by the fashion, but the storytelling was amazing. Yeah. And just even hearing Stella McCartney telling her stories about back in London and how she overcame the prejudices because she was the daughter of a famous couple, and how she cut her teeth. And there's just
lots in there.
Fabulous stories and so much to learn by watching this. It truly is an incredible series.
That's very great. That's great. Thanks very much, Don, for that. That's Irish fashion designer Don O'Neill, who has watched the first three episodes in the Vogue in the 90s new documentary. Not allowed to talk about any of the others. The new documentary series on Disney. Those first three will stream from this Friday, September the 13th. The final three will be available from September the 20th. Just in time for Milan Fashion Week, so very carefully curated by the Disney Plus people there. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night at 7. And Ray Cuddy will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.